Welcome to another episode of Software Gone Wild. A while ago, we had team building exercise. And during that podcast, we figured out that it would be great to do a few interviews with people who were networking engineers and then moved into programming. And then, surprise, surprise, we figured out that one of them is our co-host, Eliza Jasinska. And so this podcast will be just our interview with her. And because it would be so much boring to have just Eliza on the line, there are also Bob McCouch and Nick Buraglio, and they'll do the heavy lifting of asking Eliza interesting questions. Because I'm a bit like her, so, you know, whatever I would ask her would be like self-serving. So I'll stay in the background, and Nick and Bob will do the great job of trying to squeeze the last bit of information out of Eliza. So welcome, Nick, Bob, and Eliza. How are you doing?
Doing great, Evan. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you.
Hello, doing great. And did he just say I was boring? Wait.
No, I said it would be boring if the two of us would talk.
I know.
I think it would be boring with just you. No, I'm kidding.
Of course it would be. I mean, I'm really.
I'm playing.
As I said, you were a networking engineer and then you moved toward being a programmer. Why?
Yeah, we mentioned that on one of the calls a while ago, and I was trying to think a little bit about it. I don't know why. It just kind of happened naturally. This is going to be a great opportunity for me to revisit what kind of happened over the past 10 years. You rarely reflect back on, like, you know, the time that has passed. So I'm kind of curious what we're going to get to here. Let me try and remember everything. So when I started at AMSIX, and that was in 2005, 2006 or something like that. I was a network engineer. I was doing NOC and on call and installing cables in data centers, et cetera, et cetera. And then I guess it's also been a very good place to start at AMSIX because they've always been very programming close and had a lot of homegrown solutions that you had to get into. So I've already done a lot of programming things there, but it's been getting more and more over the years. And yeah, let me reflect a little bit on how that actually happened, because I don't really know.
Lisa, can I ask, from an education standpoint, did you have a background in computer science or software development, or has this been all on the job?
It has been pretty much all on the job. I went to university for a couple of years. I never really finished it.
That's okay. We won't tell anyone.
There have been a couple of like programming classes, but I don't remember much. Oh, I remember my, speaking of that, that was funny. I remember my networking class at university where I also didn't do any networking because we had like an assignment over the course of an entire SIR. I forgot it was something on like open WRTs that we had to program. I forgot what it was, but it was so super not interesting to me that I remember we were meeting up with our classmates in like a group to do our assignments. There was two guys and me, and we decided to do cooking. So I did all the cooking and they did all the networking. I've learned how to cook in that.
Okay, that's still interesting. I had to deal with the 7 layers of OSI model for half a year.
Yeah, that was that class. I listened to the theory, I read the book, but then the assignment, the programming assignment along with it wasn't fun. So I just came up with a new meal every week that I cooked for the guys and they were doing the rest.
So that's interesting, as you know, someone that comes from academia for the most part. I mean, the majority of my career has been spent in academia and research and education. I can say with certainty that there are few and far between programs that are not like vocational that actually teach you how things work in the real world. A lot of it is, you know, theoretical, coming up with new concepts and things like that, or it's, you know, sort of minimized to the least common denominator, which to anyone that's got any experience or is highly technical is going to be rudimentary and boring. Like there doesn't seem to be any middle ground there that I've ever seen. Cause I've looked, you know, my background is, hell, I went to art school, right? And so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I went to art school, minored in film, and part of a minor in computer science that I never finished because COBOL programming is boring. So, and that's what they were teaching. But, you know, I looked around and looked around. There wasn't really anything. I mean, you've got vocational schools that will actually teach you how to do stuff, but even that is going to be fundamentals.
You know, you just got to end up at the right school with the right profile, I think. Because I, you know, the school I went to, they certainly had a couple of really close to real life things going on. Unfortunately, not in networking. And kind of the fact that I ended up there was completely unrelated. And I'm guessing just sitting through the programming classes probably helped a little bit of, you know, getting the concepts in, and like just hearing it in the background kind of makes you remember, oh yeah, there was something about this later when you actually try to learn it for something, you know, some problem you're trying to solve. But let's assume that everything was kind of learning while doing sort of thing.
Okay, so let's do a step back. With your great experience cooking through the networking class, what brought you into networking in the first place?
Oh my God, this is all so long ago. This is funny. So I went to do an Erasmus exchange year in Amsterdam. I don't know. I just thought Amsterdam was cool and I signed up for it and there were spots available. So I went to Amsterdam and then I had a chance to attend the networking classes at the Amsterdam University that were taught by the Tannenbaum professor who, you know, the networking books, you guys remember.
Really?
Yeah.
No, really?
That is cool.
Now I'm so jealous.
So most of the class during the semester was taught by his co-professor, but he showed up for like one or two, I remember. And it was basically going through his book. And that kind of got me there. And then I was in Amsterdam already. And then AMSIX was there. And I don't know, I applied for an internship.
And the rest, as they say, is history, right?
And the rest, as they say, is history. I got an internship. So I got in there. I've never done anything with networking, never done any programming, and they needed an S-Flow solution.
I think I've come to the conclusion that no one plans to get into networking as a career.
Yeah, that's at least true in my case. I mean, I learned it by working in the art department, running the network there so that I could go to school. So it was totally by chance.
How did you get there, Bob?
I was actually finishing a computer science degree at RPI in New York, here in the U.S., and I was kind of past the point where I enjoyed programming. Honestly, I actually enjoyed programming immensely when it was many of the kinds of, you know, simple problem solving events that I think we'll actually see in the network automation space for a while, right? So something you can kind of sit down, bang out in a few hours, and once it turned into a lot of designing functional specs and estimating lines of code and, you know, and just writing some, you know, little function that does a little data munge on something, it got a lot less interesting. And I realized that for a long time, you know, kind of bootstrapping my career was going to be doing a lot of that, you know, what they call maintenance coding, right? Just fixing bugs in someone else's code that you've got no context awareness of or anything like that. And so I was sort of falling out of love with programming. And it just so happened that the university was essentially starting up a Cisco networking academy. And so I decided to forego the last course that I needed to complete my minor in psychology, which I think was game theory or something like that. And I thought I would take a chance on this course called Introduction to Computer Networking. That was pretty much it. As soon as I, you know, that was the first moment I saw a router other than something I might buy at the local electronics store. I really took to it. It was really, you know, interesting and intriguing to me. And I think what, for me, something that has been very interesting over the years is a lot of the stuff that I learned in you know, my computer science curriculum. So things like understanding, you know, hardware access and semaphores and how operating systems work and queuing theory and all those sorts of things that are all necessary parts of computer science have actually had fairly direct translations to understanding networking concepts. So I think there's actually, I mean, I think it was very helpful to me. It's been very helpful to me to have that background in computer programming, computer science in my career for networking. But it was definitely nothing that I set out to do and say, you know, I'm going to do networking. It was kind of something that fell into my lap literally last semester, senior year, and it just spoke to me. And I've done nothing but networking ever since.
I did set out to learn it at some point because I remember there was this thing of all the programming stuff, and I didn't have anything to do with computers before I started university. I never even had a computer when I was a teenager, so I kind of fell into it completely randomly in the first place. But then all the, like, when people were talking about the programming and then how things get to the program, into the browser and HTTP, et cetera, et cetera, everything confused me because I never really got how it got there in the first place. Like, how does it even get to my browser sort of thing? And I don't know, I always needed to understand the full background. So I'm like, okay, let's start at the lowest level that I can start off, the cable. And yeah, kind of got stuck at that level, I guess.
Here's an interesting observation, and you guys can and tell me if you think I'm reaching here. But so you're doing DevOps and development stuff now. You kind of started as a, you know, at an exchange, which is arguably, you know, a critical component of a service provider. And then, you know, a lot of other people that I've worked with that have gone the route of working at DevOps type of positions or just in general moved into coding. They've come from either a service provider or an academic background, whereas I'm struggling to think of anyone that I know of that's gone DevOps from like the enterprise world. Mm. Am I reaching there, or is that fairly consistent with what you guys have seen?
I think that's fair, because definitely the reason that AMZIX was a very small team and there was a lot of scripting going on and homegrown solutions and we were trying to figure things out, things like that just don't happen in an enterprise environment. So you don't really touch it a lot in that environment. And that's definitely if you're, you know, either a, I don't know, maybe any startup will probably do where you just have very broad, overreaching, you know, functions because there's not enough people around to actually deal with everything in kind of this enterprise siloed way.
No, but there is one other thing. M6 ran network as their core business, and you would expect any decent organization to innovate in their core business and try to get better in what they do as their core business. Whereas in typical enterprise space, IT is just a support function like plumbing or, I don't know, janitors.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that kind of helps frame what I was thinking because, you know, when you've got the multiple components of, you know, smaller staff numbers, larger environment, potentially to support that is the core business or what the business is selling. It's the product as opposed to, you know, very likely some doesn't matter what the product is, right? It can be insurance, it can be widgets or whatever. Their profit comes from something completely independent. You know, the funding source is independent of that function, right? So they can just keep funneling money into that as long as they are selling their widgets or whatever. And so the need to do some of the automation pieces or the DevOps type stuff is not quite as, you know, it's just not there in that type of environment, I think.
Yeah, to rephrase that, in a service provider environment, the question is, how do we make more money with networking? And in the enterprise side, it's just don't break anything so that the business continues to run.
That's exactly right.
That's absolutely it. And I think we've even seen instances, you know, once you start to look at the cloud scale where those really big networks, you know, we spoke to, you know, Russ White a few months ago, right? And, you know, he made it clear at LinkedIn, and I think we would hear this about other providers as well, is the companies of that size and of that focus, they start to recognize that the network is a core component of their product. And so it requires the same level of attention and investment and development. And that's where, you know, those are the environments that are looking heavily at DevOps and automation as something that will give them real value that they can understand rather than maybe just some buzzword that they think they're supposed to be doing because they read about it in CIO magazine or something.
Well, and to take that one step further, I think that that's one of the things that is able to drive, and that's why cloud providers are focused on enterprise, right? Because the network isn't part of their business, right? It's just like Ivan said, it's a support function. So they can just move as much of that out there as possible and let those people do the network automation pieces.
And it's also just hard to learn in an environment like that, you know, where they expect for everything to kind of be set up and ready versus in a, you know, startup team. You're kind of given the opportunity more to learn new things, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. I think we've gone off the rails a little bit though from our original topic. Partially my fault. Okay, so to take a step back, when you were first working with AMZIX and you were doing some DevOps stuff, it was your original S-Flow project, right? And then you wrote that in Perl, if I remember right.
That's right. Yeah. They had a lot of, but that's always, I never really cared about what things were written in. It was just, you know, everything AMZIX had was written in Perl. So, okay, let's learn that and try and figure this out somehow. Because it doesn't really, you know, you guys are all like getting in languages every other week now. Everyone's doing the Go thing or whatever. And it's really just, you know, a functionality that helps you solve a problem. If you write it in that syntax or in another syntax, does it really matter? It's always a matter of learning the modules that are in all of those like scripting languages. There's all the thousands of modules available that in the ultimately know how to apply them. And do you know how to write something by using all the tools that are available? And yes, granted, it takes a while to kind of learn all the tools along the way.
That's a really good point, right? That it doesn't really, I mean, that was when we were writing that, Perl was the language du jour for network automation stuff, right? I mean, everybody did. I even did Perl back then, and I'm a terrible programmer.
Right, like 10 years ago, everyone was doing Perl.
Right, and then it moves to whatever. But I think the point is it doesn't really matter what those things are, right? Because there's always going to be, it's just like every other thing where you've got, oh, well, this is the newest widget. This is the newest router. This is the newest interface speed, right? That's going to scale. There's a sliding window of that. And the same thing is going to be true of whatever programming language you happen to be writing in. And it doesn't really matter, right? As long as you can support it.
And it's the same thing that we're doing between Ansible and Puppet and et cetera. If there's already someone in that environment who knows a little bit about it, it's always the obvious choice to go with something that is easier supported by someone else who's also on the team. So then ultimately, the next job I had after that was at Limelight. And then I got into the team at Limelight and two of the guys there were dabbling a little bit in Python. And they were like, writing the 10-liner scripts. And I'm like, okay, well, that's what you guys are going to understand. So that's right, the next thing in Python.
I think those programming language choices will kind of always be a bit of a religious war. It's something that I think there's a long and distinguished history of religious wars within programming languages in the computer science field.
Hey, it's like OSPF versus ESRP. Who cares?
Right. I mean, it's just another tool in the toolbox, right? You're going to have that with, you got Star Wars versus Star Trek and Mac versus PC. And I think the point that we need to keep reiterating to people out there is that having choices is a good thing.
Absolutely.
But, also having an environment where you can support that choice for a longer period of time is important for the business, right? So sticking to one thing eventually makes sense. And for Amzix, it made sense to continue doing their things in Perl because they had people on the team that somewhat understood what Perl was doing and, so just keeping it in line with everything else in the environment.
I was going to say, so you're at AM6, you're writing this S-Flow tool, it's in Perl, but you're still doing network engineering pieces, right? You're still configuring switches and routers and peerings and all that good jazz. Is that accurate?
Right, that's accurate. So that was a very nice mix, and I spent quite some time there. I think I worked there for 4 or 5 years. It was always a mix of 2 days a week, sit at a data center, plug in cables, do installs, have the on-call shifts going on, and then in the remaining free time that you might get in between, write the code. It's always been a very fun mix of stuff, and I kind of liked it, and I'm regretting that a little bit as I moved on through other jobs. It's been getting more and more programming and less of the operational stuff, which is, on one hand, it makes sense because eventually the programs are getting bigger and you got to focus on the thing that you're actually doing. And then there's not that much time left anymore. On the other hand, I don't know, you sometimes have those days where you just can't focus and can't do anything. And it's so much harder. I'm speaking of those days when I'm super hungover because whatever happened the day before. And those days are really hard to actually try and focus on something programming versus standing in a data center and plugging in fibers was the easiest thing to do at that point. So that was kind of nice to lose in between, the mindless manual action and the, oh God, I got to think about this work.
Okay, so now some outages make more sense.
Right. Those are brown bottle outages.
No. We always had install plans. Everything was prepared. Cables were ordered and, everything was ready to go to a site to get it built, etc. So everything was very well planned out. So once you're standing there with your, 244 fiber pairs that need to be cleaned and plugged in, it's just clean plug, clean plug, clean plug.
And then you bring down M6 because someone didn't configure BPDU guard on the port, right?
That might or might not have happened.
So you're in this job at AM6, and this actually parallels very closely with what I have been saying is the best IT path for being, opening up choices, right? So you've got access to a Unix box that you're writing code on. So you're at least understanding the fundamentals of, Unix-based services and systems. You're automating pieces of the network. You're also touching all of the gear so that you have, you know, a fundamental understanding of what your code is going to touch and then execute on whatever equipment is that you're working on or whatever Unix system that it's manipulating. So you've got a very, very well-rounded picture of what it means to run an ecosystem that is a production network, right?
Right, exactly.
And I think that's really important, and that's really something that we need that folks need to understand is, you know, you can learn the code, you can learn the networking, but once you merge those things together, and it's like an epiphany of understanding of how all of this stuff works as a system. And so you're doing that, and then did you gradually change to doing more and more programming and less router jockeying?
Yeah. It just kind of happened that way, because once you know, in like 4 or 5 people teams, you're the one understands most of the programming, you kind of end up doing it all. So like mostly, I was always part of networking teams, which was kind of funny. I was never really on like a programming team per se. So you were always the one person on the team that wrote the scripting or like did the automation to some extent.
Okay.
And at that point was still, you know, kind of in the scripting category of things. And in the last couple of years now, I feel like that changed into, I would pretty much say today my job is full-time programmer.
And so it just gradually happened over time, and you were cool with that, right? It was just it just kept happening, and then one day you woke up and said, "Hey, I'm a programmer now."
I'm a programmer. I kind of like it, you know. I like it maybe for completely different reasons. I like the freedom that comes with it. I like the, you know, I always like to not have to move for the job and work remotely. So the fact that I can sit at home and live my life and work from my desk, and that's just easier with programming than it is with networking. If you don't have to do the operational stuff anymore, if you don't have to be like in the vicinity of the data, actually go and fix things, just the remote stuff becomes easier. So I think that was a big push for me to get more into that, because that kind of opened more opportunities without the relocation attached to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, as you moved into that and you're writing the code, do you currently have to support your code on a production basis? Like, are you on call if a piece of code or a module that you wrote starts going haywire, they call you up and say, "Hey, fix this"?
Yeah, maybe not necessarily on call, like, you know, no one calls me in the middle of the night that, well, they might like chat me up in the middle of the night that stuff is broken, but then it's usually enough if I fix it the next day sort of thing. But I do everything from, so the last couple of projects looked like, you know, design the whole system, design the whole program, get everything installed, and then support it throughout production. It's pretty much the thing that we call DevOps, right? I mean, it's like bring it to life, program it, operate it, and everything in one go.
And what sorts of things are you, like, what sorts of projects are you working on now? So is it infrastructure automation software?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's mostly infrastructure automation. There's still a little bit of flow stuff. There's still a little bit of accounting things going on, but mostly it's about software automating networky things. And I don't know, it just seems like very DevOpsy these days. Like, but then most of the time I'm spending in DevOpsy things, I'm not really, you know, whenever you guys talk about using, I don't know, Ansible and using Jenkins and using stuff to like do networking stuff with it, I'm actually still using those tools to do my programming things with it, right? So I was all happy that we set up all the deployments and like, you know, automated builds and deployments with like Jenkins, but that's all for software really. So not so much for networking as you are trying to use it.
Interesting. So, well, I guess that just speaks to the power of those tools. They're flexible enough to do that.
Well, that's really what they were meant for, right? I had a big revelation. I went to a Python conference the other week, which was very interesting. It was my first programming conference ever. I was looking at all the presentations people were doing there and like, you know, doing their builds and doing their DevOps and using all the different backends and database and Jenkins and Redis and whatnot. And I'm like, huh, that kind of sounds like all the stuff that I'm doing at work. Like, I'm really closer to those programming people these days. So that was a fun experience. But yeah, there's definitely things that we're trying to, I always call it abuse, because to some extent, you know, we're trying to use the Git the way that it was meant to do programming and our networking. And we're trying to use the Jenkins to like roll out stuff in networks for and abuse it to some extent to do something in our world, which always feels a little bit odd. But I mean, there's definitely ways to do that and to get the, you know, old school network engineers a little bit adjusted into how they can make things easier. I know, like on a project right now, it took me quite some time. I set up the Ansible system around to like generate all our configurations. And then in the first instance, it was like, but I still have to type all of this into, I still have to type all of those IP addresses in here. And then it's going to generate my mesh. And that sucks. And that sucks. And then a month or two later, it was like, oh, I only need to write this IP address down once. Getting really cool. I can use this. So, you know, there's always it always takes a while for people to adjust to whatever they're going to use.
And did you find that, you know, in the case of writing infrastructure automation tools, have you found that there was a standing requirement for a high level of consistency across the infrastructure that was necessary before you were able to start really doing a lot of tool development? Or was it the other way around? Was the development of the tools the thing that ended up driving and creating consistency within the infrastructure you're working on? Because I have to imagine that, I mean, I think those two just have to go hand in hand, right? You can't automate an inconsistent environment because everything is a corner case or a one-off.
Right. Then they go hand in hand. And that's probably the most I get to touch routers these days is when it comes to like inconsistencies, because you're trying to, you know, build a template for something and you're trying to like introduce that template for everything that you're doing that is new, but then all the old stuff is going to be out of whack. And you're kind of, you need to clean that up before you can actually move to the automated system 100%. So there's been a lot of like vetting and cleaning up and like doing the kind of the overhaul of the existing situation going on. But yeah, that usually goes hand in hand with the network engineers that know why the one-offs are there and, you know, why they put them in place originally. What's going on in between the different functions of the team to like work together and try and figure that out. And no one else is going to do it because the engineers are so busy with the day-to-day task. They don't have the time to like go back and review all the route maps and make sure all the route maps are, you know, properly designed there. So, you know, someone who has the time to work on the specific like overarching project maybe has just more time to like get into it and review them and then come back with questions and be like, hey, why is this one different? Why is that? Make sure this is all in line.
I think that's one of the hidden wins of doing network automation is it's a forcing function for going through your infrastructure with a fine-tooth comb and really understanding the way it's put together and why, and then normalizing it.
Yeah, it's also funny that it's getting better, I think, in that entire space. Or maybe it's just getting more focused on companies that actually look at automation very seriously and want to work with it in a more serious manner. That it's always been treated, you know, as an important thing and as the thing that we need to focus on and work on. So that's a good thing, because if you're in a company that is trying to kind of do it on the side and not putting them in it, it's really, really hard to actually get something going.
Yeah, and it also forces consistency of naming conventions and things like that that I think are often overlooked, but critically important.
What I think is kind of interesting here is, so you started out in, you know, really the sort of the traditional IT operations role, and whether that's in a service provider or an enterprise or academia or wherever else, right? You know, there's many, many flavors of IT operations. And then at the other end, or maybe it's not even the same spectrum, but then you've got what I'll call sort of the real software developer. And I don't mean that as a detriment to anybody who's automating infrastructure, but I'm speaking of the developers that are, you know, developing a product for a company that sells software, for instance, right? You know, making a product that is not really related to IT infrastructure.
Yes.
But where you are, Lisa, from the sounds of it, is really, you know, straddling the middle of that.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I guess what, you know, it's what we've termed, you know, come to call DevOps or infrastructure engineering or, you know, whatever term you want to put on it. But it's really, it's you know, you may be doing software development as pretty much your full-time role, but that software development is really in the support of the IT infrastructure, as opposed to you've gone off and become a developer of, you know, accounting platforms or, you know, games or something like that, right? What you're doing in terms of software development is still focused on IT infrastructure and even networking specifically. And I think that's interesting. I think that really does create, I never really thought of DevOps as being a new classification of a software developer, but I think you know, I'm starting to think maybe it is, right? Maybe it really is. It's that developer that's focused on using software to drive IT infrastructure.
But then that made me wonder, isn't every software, because like for me, it seems so natural these days, isn't every software developer kind of bound to a particular business that almost like, you know, wouldn't someone who writes financial software for the past 10 years kind of stick to the financial business and not go to any other company just because he knows the problem space and the tools they're using to solve it, et cetera, wouldn't it be like that with every business?
Yeah, that I think it is. And I think that what both of you guys are saying is true, right? So we've got the financial software guy is going to probably continue in the same vein of whatever he's been doing for a long time, assuming he likes it and it's stable and whatever. But then you've got this thing over here that has existed sort of in pockets for a long time. But, you know, now that networking and the internet and online systems are such a ingrained part of society, wasn't even 15 years ago. The importance of them didn't exist. Now there's a need for this, you know, sort of rare-ish or in specialized infrastructure developer that may have existed in smaller environments. This is now bubbling up to the top and going, hey, now that we have networking everywhere, you know, on your kids' toys and on your refrigerator and whatever else, there's just more of it that needs to be managed. And so as that grows, the need for somebody who sort of understands all of those pieces is critically important to make it work.
The other interesting thing, Happy, in like a prospect of future jobs is that I kind of feel I've gotten so much into the programming space now that I could literally take a job as a Python programmer in any other company on any other product and just kind of be, you know, be a programmer like the way, which for me coming from the networking operations side is really something new and exciting. Maybe it shouldn't be, I don't know, but I've never before. So it kind of feels like, okay, whenever I get fed up with the networking stuff, I can just apply for any random programming job and maybe do something new. And then eventually it will just get easier and easier with time. There's just no easy way around that. You just gotta move through the unknown, which is always the scary part. So it's always a little bit like, oh, I don't know if I can actually do that. But then, you know, you read and you find a lot of examples, and the examples are always, or I don't know, based for normal application and products. And then you're like, how can I apply this to the problem that I'm trying to solve? Because I guess the biggest problem that I'm always having with software that we're writing, you know, everything that is a programming example on the internet will have something to do with a web application. And then it doesn't really tell you how to apply this differently. And the thought to, you know, reading the how-to and the concept of the internet is how to transform that into something that actually ends up talking to a router or being useful for some backend tool. But I guess the other interesting thing is also, it kind of moved for me in a very sequential way from scripts that were, you know, 10 and 100 lines through the second stage of the programming was kind of libraries. Because I don't know why, maybe because, you know, oftentimes libraries are open source, so there's a lot that you can look at and learn from, and then you kind of see how it's separated out, and then you use a library in a script, but it's, you know, still kind of, your actual goal is still the script, but then you write a library to kind of use it and make it easier and have a lot of examples. And then before, it kind of moved above the libraries into something that is a useful backend software that, well, I hope my backend softwares these days are a little bit useful. That took another while because like the backend portion of it that's the thing that every company has kind of figured out for themselves and how they integrate it and what they use. And they might write an open source library alongside that they put online, but then how the whole system interacts with each other, that's always the missing piece. That took me a while to figure out, I think. That's definitely a good way to start, although I had a really hard time with that because it's hard for me to understand someone else's thinking, and, you know, every program kind of reflect what the programmer was thinking at that time. Ending that is a very high barrier. I don't know, for me, it's easier to come up with something from nothing with my own thoughts than trying to dabble in something other people did. So
Elisa, would you want to do that? Or would you like to stay between networking and programming?
It could go either way.
It's good to have options, right?
I'm still figuring in 10 years I'll just be running a hot dog stand at the beach somewhere.
Yeah, she already has a sailboat, you know?
Nice.
That's right. You got to put a hot dog stand on the sailboat.
That's hilarious.
Of course. Where else would they run their containers? Come on. If we go back, let's say 10-ish years, when you started, if I understand correctly, you were always a mixture of networking engineer and a programmer. So leaning one way or another was sort of easy for you. But if I would be a hardcore networking engineer with no programming experience, any idea how I could start slowly moving into programming?
Man, don't even tell me. I'm like, I only like year or two, I finally got comfortable with anything object oriented. Like objects were always something big and scary for me forever and ever. And everything I wrote was always functional and it couldn't get any, because you know, sequential and you know when what happens, etc. And then those objects just come in from all over the place and you don't know what's happening. And those are probably concepts that would have been much easier if I would have paid attention at university. It like the last year or two, it just kind of clicked and now I feel like I'm there. But it's with everything like that, right? You wrote your first like open source backend library and you're like, oh, yes, I got it. I understand it now. And then there's still like this entire world of things. I always have those moments of, I finally know what I'm doing. Oh, wait, I actually don't know what I'm doing at all.
The way that my brain works is I have a hard time creating something from nothing. And so one of the ways that I've been trying to teach myself a little bit more or reteach myself some more development stuff is to take pieces of open source code that I find useful. You know, Rancid is a good example. I've done tons of different modules for Rancid. It's got basically three different programming languages in it. And then I've modified existing code to do things that I want it to do that it didn't do before. Do you think that that's a reasonably good way to get your feet wet, or is that off the rails?
Yeah, that's a hard question. So the only thing that really comes to mind is the library example. Like, you know, try to not write your things into a script, but try to relocate a couple of library, build something external, start splitting it up a little bit, because that's kind of what eventually gives you a sense of like a software architecture. And that's how things, if you architect things in a better way, eventually they grow and grow bigger. And the whole architecture concept really only makes sense once you have bigger tools to work with, once you have bigger programs to work with, because that's when it becomes important to like make them maintainable and actually have them separated in a way. But just, you know, make a library for something that, I don't know, the S-Flow example comes to mind again, where like the Perl thing back at AMSIX, where we wrote an S-Flow parser that was a separate library. We open sourced that. And then around that were a couple of scripts that were doing the real work of the S-Flow analysis for AMSIX. So just, you know, build little libraries would be probably a good first step. Because then a lot of building bigger tools, there's a lot of knowledge that goes on around how to package it, how to deploy it, how to roll it out, which again goes more into like that you already pick up in writing libraries that you have to deploy.
I guess the difference for me is that I have forgotten so many of the programming fundamentals, and that's why I can't just, you know, make something from a blank editor. I need to go back and look at someone else's examples of, it's basically just using reference material as the palette, because I don't remember a lot of the fundamentals that it's shameful that I don't remember. But I could see both ways.
Yeah, definitely. So reading other people's stuff and having other people read your stuff and give you feedback is definitely something that helped me forward a lot.
Okay, so let's wrap it up right here, because Elisa, I know you have to run. One thing I would add to what you just said is open source your work and make other people interested so they start working on it and maybe fix your code or add new stuff so that it starts living on its own.
Hey, Ivan, I have one more question for you, because you're kind of coming out of a similar space. You used to be a programmer. How experience with all that? I do have like 5 more minutes left, so let's use them.
Okay, so I really started as a programmer, because when I started, there was no networking. Then networking became sort of natural, because I've seen something that worked that connected a few hosts together. And of course, I had to replicate that. So I wrote my own networking code, my own networking stack. And then eventually figured out that there's this other thing out there called DECnet, and later on there's this other thing called IP, and I could never wrap my head around the idea of having addresses on interfaces and not on hosts, for example. But eventually I got across that, and it was always, you know, a mixture of, yes, I was a networking engineer, but I was always writing a little bit of code, so I am rusty. I don't program nearly enough, so I have to look up, for example, how you find a value in a Perl array every single time I have to do that. But, you know, there are some things that you never forget, like riding a bike or writing a program.
Yeah, I haven't wrapped my head around that yet. I need things to be in order or else I get confused.
I have those moments every day. So, Elisa, if I can ask if one of our listeners, is hearing your story and, is really excited by the concept of moving even beyond writing little scripts and day-to-day tools and moving more toward the path that you've taken, what do you think their first steps are to really migrating toward more of a software development role?
But it's a lot of practice, right? Because how to look up values, how to use certain libraries, just becomes clear if you've done it 1,000 times, you just know by heart how to do it, and then you just don't have to look it up anymore.
Cool.
Oh, you keep forgetting I look it up every time.
There's also a lot of tools. When I started writing, I didn't use any of them, but you know, by now I have all the syntax checkers and all the unit tests and all the stuff that kind of helps you develop that you don't really, initially, you don't really see a need for them. But once your program grows, it actually makes those things around. But that step I've really been taking the past 2 years or so. So,
and by the way, that's a perfect topic for another podcast. So let's stop right here. Elisa, if someone wants to get in touch with you and get more details, how can they find you?
That always question. There's a lot of, I guess it's on Twitter or Big Wave IT for consulting stuff. And yeah, that would probably help already.
Perfect. Thank you. And Bob, where can people find you?
Easiest way to find me is on Twitter. I am at Bob McCouch.
And Nick?
The easiest way to find me is probably on Twitter as well, at Baralio. I also blog at forwardingplane.net.
And you can find me at ipspace.net or send me a tweet at ioshints. And you've been listening to Software Gone Wild, podcast focused on everything software defined, including programming.